It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
We used to be able to look at threats and say that they're kind of over there. But now, with cyber threats and disinformation and attacks on critical infrastructure, and threats have come into our countries, our intelligence agencies are just much more important to everyday citizens.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Ben Scott, Senior Advisor at the ANU National Security College. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay my respects to their elders, past and present. We're doing something different today. I'm joined by Peter Ford, Senior Advisor at NSC, and we will co-host this episode. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Ben.
We're going to be talking about intelligence and statecraft with Beth Sanner, who is a senior fellow at Harvard University Belfer Center and former U.S. Deputy Director for National Intelligence, where she oversaw the integration of collection, analysis, and program oversight throughout the U.S. intelligence community. In this role, she also served as the President's Intelligence Briefer. Welcome, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Wonderful to have you here, Beth. So today, as good intelligence analysts, I think we're probably going to have some disagreements. I hope we're going to aim to have some disagreements to keep this interesting. We're going to try and cover a wide range of topics, but I want to start with something really quite basic and fundamental, which is really just the question of what is intelligence? What's the point of intelligence? Why are our nations spending so much money on this particular activity? I have a very simple answer to that question. I know Peter has quite a sophisticated one, so we already have a difference there. So I'm going to start with Peter and then I'll go to you, Beth.
Thanks, Ben. So for me, formally, the definition of intelligence is the activities, processes, and outputs that relate to the acquisition, processing, and dissemination of information. That's the sort of definition you're going to find, though, in doctrines, in legislation around the world. So the other one you'll come across is maybe some more simple definitions. So something like intelligence is covertly obtained information. Intelligence is information gathered that involves threats to national security. Maybe information that's collected, processed, narrowed to meet the demands of decision makers. Or even retired Canadian Brigadier General James Cox had a definition in a paper last year. Intelligence is the capacity for reasoned foresight that enables advantageous action. I find a lot of those all a little clunky in there. To be honest, you do intelligence and then you get intelligence and you do more intelligence and an output is intelligence. It's a verb, it's a noun, it's a really clunky sentence. But it covers so much intelligence. That's one of the benefits. It's a multidisciplinary approach. Beth, your perspective on this?
That's a bit overwhelming. And I think it might be for our listeners, right? I guess I kind of am a more simple person. And I think that I agree with all of those things, right? But the purpose of intelligence is to give policymakers decision advantage. And that's what we talk about in the U.S. a lot. It's to help policymakers make the most informed decisions possible. And so, you know, what intelligence offers is not just the information that they can't get from anywhere else, but hopefully the insight that is derived from understanding the context and being able to communicate the context and the relationship, but mostly to come and provide that at the right time and in the right way to help people make better decisions.
Right. The definition of intelligence as giving decision advantage is a real classic. Just because I mentioned earlier that I have a simpler definition, I'm going to throw that into the mix as well. So for me, intelligence really is just information that's useful for national security. And I think there's a strong argument for keeping it simple these days because we are trying to integrate the intelligence enterprise. And unless we have one kind of simple concept to rally around, it gets harder to do. And the other reason I like that definition is because it's agnostic as to security classification, so it creates a lot more space for open source intelligence, topic I'm sure I'm going to come back to. But I would also very much like to demarcate intelligence as information from all the other things that intelligence organizations do that are now thought of as intelligence. So everything operational, for example. To me, those are all very important activities, but calling them intelligence and calling information itself intelligence to me has created a lot of confusion, bureaucratic and otherwise, that we're still trying to unpick. So I'm going to ask you both for any responses to any of those, but at the same time, I want to throw another question back to you, Beth, a particular question about the role of intelligence, which is this question of truth to power. It's one that intelligence officers love to say that our role is to speak truth to power. I know you have some particular thoughts on that and I'd like to share them with the listeners.
I do, but let me get back to that idea. And I really like your definition of being useful, because when you focus on decision advantage, you're kind of keeping it inside this box of here's the intelligence community telling a policymaker something that they need to decide on or that they need to think about to prepare to support national security interests. And I think we'll get back to this later, but this idea of being useful also might get into this idea of intelligence diplomacy or the idea of using intelligence to help the public or help our partners around the world understand the world and threats and what's going on. And so that definition of usefulness is nicely broad. I don't know, you know, if it matters that much, except that I think it's very important for people to understand the service and the mission of intelligence communities around the world, at least, you know, our allied ones, is really to be helpful. On the question of truth to power, I definitely have written something on this. People can Google it and disagree with it, which maybe a lot of people do. And when I wrote it, I think that this idea of truth to power is particularly controversial in the United States and with CIA folks, because, you know, if you walk into CIA headquarters, you'll see the inscription on the wall, thou shalt know the truth and it shall set you free. And it is really part of the CIA and the intelligence community ethos in the United States that there is this truth. And with political polarization and controversy, you know, you just heard people pounding the drum, just this drumbeat of you must tell truth to power. You know, it's essential that people do that. And of course, they're right in the way, in the idea behind that, which is that laid out in the statute in the United States that formed the intelligence community, it actually says that the requirement is that you provide relevant and objective analysis without regard to policy preferences. So that's the definition of what people actually want when they say truth to power. But much of what we do really isn't about truth. It's about assessment. Mm-hmm. It's about saying what you know and acknowledging what you don't know and giving some sense of how confident you are about that. But it's not really about, you know, putting a stake in the ground and saying, this is the truth. And I worry that as we teach this to every new analyst and we drill this into their heads that this is their job to tell truth to power, and you hear our intel oversight people talking about how important it is, it's actually giving absolutely the wrong message to people. It's telling them that they can somehow own the truth. And none of us own the truth. We do our best to understand what we think is right. But if we don't have the humility to understand that we could be wrong, and if we are so locked into our thoughts that what we know is actually the truth, then how are we ever going to recognize when events shift, when assumptions change? You know, we'll have intel failure because we won't know what's going on. And the last part of it is, sorry to go on here, but it's just a total buzzkill for people to have you sit in front of them and lecture you about what the truth is, particularly if maybe you don't agree or, you know, the person on this side of the table doesn't agree. And I think that that kind of arrogance, you know, borders on hubris. And I think it just undercuts the relationship of trust and integrity that is the essence of the relationship between policymakers and the intelligence community. And I don't think that you can have a conversation if you're not listening and if you aren't open to maybe what that policymaker is saying that's different. Mm-hmm. You need to think about it and then have a debate, but be open to it.
Yeah.
And once you put the line in the sand that something's truth, you kind of shut that down.
Yeah. I mean, I have to admit, I was really brought up on truth to power as well, and I really believed it. It makes you feel also more important in the work you do. But yeah, your piece and the argument you've just made has really made me reconsider a lot of that. I think there's a lot in that. What about you, Peter? Has your mind changed on that topic?
I'm with Beth on that. I think it's too grandiose. It's too simplistic to say truth to power. There's more nuance in what intelligence assessments are there for. And things like trust with your intelligence customers are vital to get to that. And there's not always someone who can own the truth, right? As you said. Right. So often intelligence assessments will be providing the best information and the best judgment they have at a certain point in time. And that's okay. It's not necessarily the truth at that point in time. Mm-hmm. So understanding that and walking customers through that is great. And I think dispelling that myth for a junior analyst or someone coming on board is really powerful as well. A quick side note on that truth to power. We in Australia, we have a couple of sections in our legislation. So things like in the ONI legislation, the Prime Minister can give directions to the Director General of National Intelligence, but in respect to the content or conclusions that come back, can't guide those as well. So that gives some legislative freedom and strength to that ability to be robust in those assessments and to be bold in those assessments. So for us, that's codified in legislation as well.
Yeah, I think this whole idea of like, I'm not saying that anybody should pull their punches, quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. Right? But it's that clarity of what is the essence of what you're saying. It's not truth, but it's assessment. And some of that includes fact. And you should be very, very clear about that and bold, as you say, Peter, in that, and not be afraid of doing that. And I just rather call it, making a call.
Yeah. So I think so that for me, that discussion about the role of intelligence, the role of objectivity, the question of truth to power is a perfect lead-in to this whole question of strategic declassification and intelligence diplomacy, which is so hot right now, as they say. It's something that's really followed on from the lead-up to Russia's invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago, when we saw the United States and the UK downgrading, declassifying, disseminating intelligence at what is widely regarded as an unprecedented speed and scope, and using it for effect. So using it to wrongfoot Putin, to pre-bunk, as they say, some of the false flag operations, and also rally a coalition. So a real instrumentalization of intelligence, which has gathered momentum, as we understand, and is often now captured under this broader umbrella of what's called intelligence diplomacy. Now, I have to confess myself a skeptic. For me, I'm still a bit old school there. Intelligence is one thing. Diplomacy is something else. Producing intelligence that's useful and usable is a good idea, but there are always risks. And something that really struck out for me in the early discussion of the new US approach to strategic declassification was in one of the early reports about how it all worked in Politico, where Avril Haines said something that was really interesting to me, which was that we shared stuff that didn't make sense to us. So to me, there's a big difference between taking intelligence and instrumentalizing it, using it to achieve a particular objective, which is useful intelligence in a maybe more questionable way, and sharing it more broadly, being more upfront and honest, sharing it with partners in the same way that you would share with your own leadership. I was struck that there was no reference to that in a much more detailed account of how strategic declassification works, which was published in Time, I think, a bit earlier this year, February or March this year. So I wonder if that's still the case. So for me, there's some risks. The other thing I read about it, which I looked at to get more information, was an article in Foreign Affairs by the current head of INR, again, about intelligence diplomacy, which to me read as actually a description of a lot of the things that intelligence organizations should do. I mean, they should be providing support for meeting foreign policy objectives. And if you look at the definition of intelligence diplomacy in that piece, it really captures pretty much everything that I would have thought INR and other organizations like it would already be doing. So I wonder how much is new there. So my question to both of you is, am I just being an old stick-in-the-mud skeptic, or is there something more there that I'm missing? Maybe I'll go to you first, Peter.
Yeah, I'm a little torn on this one. I think you're right in terms of the role that intelligence has always played in helping foreign policy. That's business as usual for me for intelligence and is absolutely what they should be doing. But what we've seen in the last couple of years, and it's become more explicit with the phrase strategic declassification, is ramping that up a little bit. I have worries on the level of politicization and bringing intelligence into being more of a formal part of the role of government there rather than being the supporting and enabling function. That's probably my biggest concern with this one. But I think there's a strong and powerful role that intelligence agencies and intelligence communities play in that engagement. And that's absolutely fine. That's appropriate. But we've been doing that for years and years. Beth?
So I think that the idea of using this strategic declassification in advance of the Russian invasion was a brilliant move needed at an unprecedented time. And I think it's pretty hard for us to look at this example and say, oh, that was a bad idea. I think it was a really good idea.
Great.
And people should be congratulated for the creativity and thinking through that, and the intelligence communities involved and the agencies involved should be congratulated for figuring out how to do that. And it seems to me, looking in from the outside, to have done that without losing too much in terms of their ability to continue to collect on the war. I mean, at the time, I was very worried about it because I was like, wow, right before this is going to happen, we could be blowing sources and methods that make it very, very difficult for us to monitor the war as it's unfolding. Right. So I was very worried about it, but clearly the professionals in charge of that figured out how to do that.
Yeah.
And so that's great. I agree with you that much of what's being described as intelligence diplomacy seems like kind of business as usual to me. And the idea of setting a name on it or program around it has pros and cons for me. I think I don't actually like the phrase of intelligence diplomacy because it puts it squarely in the policymaking milieu and therefore can set up a precedent for somebody to use it to politicize. And I think that, you know, in my career, certainly looking back over many controversies over many administrations, there were times when the administration wanted people to release particular information or to even just to focus on that in their analysis. And that wasn't actually the full picture.
Right.
So what comes to mind is maybe the Iraq War or, whether Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11 and those kinds of things, right, where there was pressure. And so what if you take that example of people, and there are many, as I said, this happens all the time because policymakers have policy preferences, right? Yeah. And they want support in trying to implement that policy. It's natural. But there needs to be a red line between intel and policy.
Right.
And when you label something as being one and the same, then you can be on a slippery slope to somebody trying to use this process in order to promote a particular policy agenda that maybe the intelligence doesn't fully support, that you get policymakers cherry picking pieces of intelligence that support their viewpoint, but might just be those a cherry among a big bunch, right? And so that's the problem with that. And so it means that you have to have a system and a process that ensures the independence of intelligence agencies and that they are given the ability to push back in that system.
Right.
And I don't know whether we have processes, institutionalized systems and processes that would protect us in times when somebody is inclined to do that.
Yeah.
And so I, for that reason, I have some concerns.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in the Australian context, so that kind of red line between policy and intel is very long established. It was kind of absolutely central to the commissions which set up the Australian intelligence community. It's reinforced again and again. Perhaps it did become a bit blurred at some point, or some vision of that line was lost, but it was reinforced very heavily in a very large report by Dennis Richardson a couple of years ago, which was nominally about legislation about intelligence. But he took the time to set out, you know, these are the basic building blocks on which our intelligence community is built, and they're not widely understood enough anymore, and that education needs to be reinforced. I think that's a really important point. And I think it's one that's going to become more important as pressure on intelligence organizations grows to produce more useful information. So as I said earlier, I think that's a good definition of intelligence, useful information, but it needs to be not useful in a way that's useful for policymakers to meet their particular preferences at this point in time. And so the only way you become more useful, but at the same time don't cross those red lines, is to try and do both at the same time, to really strengthen the independence, make that red line thicker, I think, and stronger, and at the same time shift the emphasis to providing more useful information, whether we call it strategic declassification or intelligence diplomacy or whatever. That's kind of where I land.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
And I get back to that statute in the United States as well, objective, relevant objective without regard for policy preference. And that just needs to be doubled down by the leaders of the intelligence community, and they have to be able to say no.
Yeah.
I'd just like to follow up on one quick point there, Beth, where you said the first part of making your point there on those who made the decision should be congratulated in it as well. I think that's a really bold decision by the agencies and the institutions that were approving that and getting it out there, and I too would congratulate them on that. There's probably a role here for public intelligence in that sense. So making some whether you want to call it strategic declassification or just the role of public assessments. In Australia, we don't have a strong culture of that. I'm thinking particularly in the US, and particularly the ODNI have the Global Trends Report they put out, or some of the legislative requirements to brief Congress on things.
Annual threat assessment.
Yeah, the closest we have in Australia is probably the annual threat assessment by Director General Security.
But what I was going to say is that the US annual threat assessment is much more, it's much larger than us, much more wide-reaching. It's the whole world. It's not, Australia domestic.
Would you then, launching from intelligence diplomacy, would you say there's a role for intelligence agencies to be more public and more open in their assessments on things like that?
I think that there absolutely has to be more transparency about the threat picture from intelligence agencies to the public. And I think that the U.S. intelligence community right now is in a pretty good place in trying to do that. I mean, you see agency heads really leaning forward in having those conversations. You see that around the annual threat assessments. But increasingly, you know, when you look at the threat picture for us, and I think it's similar here in Australia, we used to be able to look at threats and say that they're kind of over there.
Mm-hmm.
And geography for both Australia and the United States kind of worked in our favor. And threats didn't really affect other outside of war most regular people. But now with cyber threats and disinformation and attacks on critical infrastructure and effects on trade and migration and you name it, terrorism, of course. threats have come into our countries. And so for that reason, I think that we have to be able to have communications much more, because our intelligence agencies are just much more important to everyday citizens and the work that we do. And it's our responsibility. They pay for us.
Yeah.
It's our responsibility to help people understand the world. But I don't think that it has to be done kind of in the traditional method of, you know, writing your very classified report and then figuring out how to downgrade that information so then you can share it. I think it would be much better if we started off with a construct of how can we tell the story that we know about from all of the exquisite influence and intelligence, all the exquisite intelligence that we have, but how can we tell that story in an unclassified manner and start from there and then add on the bells and whistles for our policymaker constituents that need to know that. And if we could start that way and really emphasize the open source, because so much of our world now is available in open source, I think we would be in a much better place in terms of trying to do that communication without having to go through the rigmarole of threatening sources and methods.
Yeah. I have some particularly strong thoughts on this topic, which I'll just hold off on for a little bit longer. I don't want to come there with a slight detour. So just going back to Ukraine, so the strategic declassification that led up to Ukraine was a great success. I agree with that completely, just to make that clear. And in the popular imagination, I think it really lifted the reputation of the intelligence community and in some ways wiped away some of the negative associations that came from 20 years earlier, so Iraq 2003, another form of strategic declassification or intelligence diplomacy, which, as you mentioned, was a little more problematic. So that was a great success for the IC, but the apparent failure to correctly assess the Ukrainians' will to fight is widely regarded as an intelligence failure. And I'm putting big square quotes here around intelligence failure because it's a very problematic term. But I think it's a useful one to think about because there have been kind of a series of these events. So you can, in terms of will to fight, you can say Ukraine, an underestimation of the Ukrainians' will to fight. More recently in the case of Hamas, an underestimation not just of Palestinians or Hamas' will to fight, but also an underestimation of the continued kind of global resonance of that issue. Afghanistan National Security Forces, an overestimation of will to fight. You could perhaps even throw in January 6th if you wanted to as well to make it a bit more complicated. I just wonder if either of you have particular thoughts on these kind of big, again, in square quotes, intelligence failures. Does it tell us anything about this more complex threat picture that we're facing, about the role of open source, about the role of traditional intelligence organizations? Is it enough to say, for example, as some might, well, these are mysteries rather than puzzles, and so they're not the job for intelligence. That's the job for something else.
So I'm a fan when doing those type of assessments on having some sort of really clear approach to alternative futures in there and having a really structured, methodical way around exploring those alternatives. I'd certainly argue a good intelligence team should be doing checking their key assumptions. They should be red teaming their work. They should be looking at it from multiple ways and being challenged, if not having a dedicated role or position in an organization to challenge those assessments and really step back and look at the rigor that's going into those assessments. So that would be that's my first reaction to that question, Ben. Beth?
It's a really complicated question. And I think each of these things are somewhat different in the reasons that there were, I guess, in some cases, real intelligence failures. In other cases, I'm not sure there were actually failures or not. But so much of this gets back to critical thinking. And Peter, as you're saying, some of this is forcing people to go through processes of asking the right questions and looking at alternatives and checking assumptions because the underlying factors that support your assumptions change. I like people to ask the question, how could we be wrong, as something that just is regularly done. But I I also think so. Some of this is about not great thinking and assumptions that were wrong or ill-informed, maybe in some cases denial and deception. But there's a lot of complexity here, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to say exactly how it could have gone better. But I do think that there's some basic ways that we can avoid these sorts of things. And it is about making sure that you understand your assumptions, that you understand what are the factors that underpin those assumptions, and like really write it down.
Right. Yeah.
Be
explicit on those and be checking those. That's one thing that I think that people don't really understand how busy intelligence analysts are, particularly in times of crisis. And so you're being pushed very hard to write and to think and to move your assessments forward. And you feel like you don't have a lot of time to do that. And so the role of leaders in those circumstances, analytic leaders, is to make space for someone to be doing that work, to slow down the thinking, and to not have everybody just doing the task force work and running on the gerbil wheel.
Right.
Because if you do that, you're going to be in big trouble in lots of ways.
Yeah.
But the other thing I think I would say is that this idea of including people in your discussions and in your coordination of your assessments who aren't the people who are primarily responsible for making that judgment.
Right.
So, you know, if we have military analysts looking at particular things, they're going to be looking at hardware, they're going to look at doctrine, they're going to look at previous cases, but they may not look at the role of corruption. They may not look at chain of command problems or the society that undergirds that system, or, you know, just any number of kind of softer factors.
Yeah.
We will tend to go toward things that we can evaluate and count.
Yeah.
As humans, all of us do that, right? I'm not picking on military analysts, but it's they're part of this case, of a number of these cases. And so I think that this applies to anything. Like, I would bring in a senior analyst from someplace completely different and have them read your argumentation and ask some questions.
We'll be right back.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
In a volatile world, Australia's strategic problem demands difficult decisions, licensed by an inclusive conversation. The ANU National Security College is proud to present Securing Our Future, a conference like no other, informing a distinctly Australian, people-centred vision of national security. Bringing together diverse Australian and international voices, we are bridging disciplines, professions, and viewpoints. Join us in Canberra on the 9th and 10th of April this year to engage with thought leaders and decision makers from government, academia, and industry. For more details and to secure your ticket, visit the link in the show notes. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
I've sometimes thought whether it might even be useful having some kind of system of anonymous peer review, like inside the IC, like you have in academia, where you don't, so then you're not dependent on senior management, even if they're brought in, or people who are in line positions already, but you just force well, force is too strong a word. You encourage or compel every specialist analyst to spend, you know, 5% of their week reading and reviewing other work, which is completely outside their area, and asking some of the basic questions that maybe nobody who's working in that area and a specialist in that area is really realizing, just to check it and make you to think again, oh, you know, it didn't even occur to us that someone might take that approach to it, or that kind of unearths some of the assumptions mm-hmm. that we didn't even realize were there.
Exactly, because you get so used to it. And I think, you know, the paradox of expertise
right.
allows us to get really locked in on some of these assumptions that someone reading it would say, hey, you know, it seems like X is underpinning your assumption. Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to be happening. I love this idea, but I think that the prerequisite for it might be lacking. And that is creating a culture where we can have, I call it a challenge culture, but a challenge culture that doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
You know, where people don't feel that their reputation is right. at risk, that they're being somehow called out or questioned. And generally in professions where your intellectual output is actually what you're graded on, it is so personal.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to create a culture where people are accepting of this. And I think that this is something we're not paying enough attention to. We're not paying enough attention to creating cultures of learning, of reflection, of getting better, and seeing these things as positive instead of as career ending potentially, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The other aspect of that I think you're both getting close to is a diversity angle there too.
Mm. Love it.
So having a multidisciplinary team, whether it's, pick your diversity category, but even if it's intelligence disciplines, neurodiversity, gender, sexuality, religion, et cetera, having that really diverse team gets you a better result in my experience as well. And that lets you uncover those assumptions and unpack a problem in a different way. I think that the way we come together, even a very ad hoc, very bespoke way to form task force and really get after a specific problem, can be really powerful. But it's something we seem to do as a community, and maybe in the Five Eyes community, around just a really ad hoc way, not a specific, really structured, deliberate mechanism.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I do as a side gig is I work on crowdsource forecasting. And one of the things I love about it is the anonymity of the crowd. That you can, if you're very careful with how you pick your crowd, you can get really good diversity in that crowd. You can get people who don't have the paradox of expertise. And you can take away the sting of challenge because it's some anonymous, anonymized, aggregated crowd.
Yeah.
And it's a great way of challenging conventional wisdom. It's not the easy button. It's not the answer. But it's a way of analysts actually thinking and being challenged and also of producing numeric probabilities mm-hmm. that are very useful, even if you don't publish them. Mm-hmm. It's very useful for people understanding what they're talking about, mm-hmm. What it actually means.
Is it something the IC could adopt institutionally?
Well, we experimented with it in the United right. States with the prediction market way back when, and I think it was an idea that was maybe a little bit before its time. Mm-hmm. The UK right now has something called Cosmic Bazaar, where I think that they're finding it very useful as a tool of tradecraft.
Yeah.
Meaning for listeners who don't understand this kind of gobbledygook, but tradecraft is just like the business of thinking
right.
and yeah. doing the work.
Right.
And so I think that there's real potential there.
Yeah. You spoke earlier about the desirability of producing assessments which are unclassified from the beginning and then seeing where we have to add in classification depending on sources and methods. I was really struck. I read the U.S. intelligence community's latest OSINT strategy, which has as its title the intelligence of first resort, set out as an objective, I assume. And that was an objective that was first articulated by the DNI, I think 2005, 2006, something like that. The fact that we haven't really moved closer to making open source intelligence, the intelligence of first resort, as far as I can tell, in either the US or Australia, is one of the reasons that I make this strong argument, which I'm not going to make it full length here now, but that we need to actually take a much more radical step and create an OSINT agency. It's not an original idea by any means. It's been floating around in the US for at least 20 years, less so in Australia. But to me, initially, I'd say I thought this was a bad idea. I really changed my mind on it in research. And the three main arguments for it, I think, first, that this is you need to make this big step to really concentrate the kind of capability, resources, tradecraft, as you said, of OSINT really in one area to develop it as much as possible. Secondly, because OSINT and secret intelligence are fundamentally different. They differ from one another in more substantial and meaningful ways than, say, SIGINT and HUMINT do, for example. They're just different ways of pursuing secret intelligence. But the different classifications, I think, is a big, big distinction. And so OSINT and secret intelligence, they have different advantages and disadvantages. And you want to capitalize on the advantages of both. If you try and do both within one classified umbrella, I think you smother down and you lose a lot of the advantages of OSINT. But third, and this is probably the most controversial, is I think that OSINT has a kind of a disruptive power. And by doing OSINT separately and independently and having this OSINT agency produce those unclassified assessments to begin with, it creates some kind of competitive pressure inside the IC, which we don't have at the moment. And so you don't anymore have a choice as an intelligence analyst whether to use open source as first resort or not, because that choice is made for you, because the OSINT agency is out there and it is producing unclassified reports, and that has to be the starting point for your own assessments. And it actually forces you then to focus your scarce, expensive, exquisite capabilities much more narrowly on which I think is the continuing importance of secret intelligence. I mean, it's not that OSINT makes secret intelligence irrelevant, but it means that secret intelligence has to become a much more honed, disciplined practice. So that's my argument for OSINT. Both of you are free to argue against it now.
Well, I think I go back and forth on whether I think that we have to have a new agency in the U.S. intel system. Depends on the day of the week and what I've had for lunch. And the reason for that is that maybe let me step back just a minute for listeners and say, you know, what is OSINT, mm-hmm. right? It's not, when I say people should start writing from open source or, you know, start with an unclassified big line judgment and then use the exquisite stuff to support that judgment. It's different than saying, I'm going to have a group of people who go about the craft of finding information that maybe it is not secret, but it may be hidden.
Right.
Right. So if you think about my favorite examples are Bellingcat, because people have heard of them, and their ability to figure out who poisoned Alexei Navalny. And the way that they went about that was not by reading the press.
Right.
It's that they understood, as people who understood Russia, and at least some of them spoke Russian, read Russian, they understood where that information could be in the system, what they would need to do to track down people through airplane manifests, through license plate numbers that they could buy off the gray market, through in phone records that aren't the same as SIGINT intercepts, but like phone records that they could identify cell phone calls, again, that they could buy somehow off the gray market. That's not the same as right. doing, you know, having unclassified assessments, right? But that is exactly what we need to do in the system. And what I fear is that We really need to train people, and they need to have special skills, and they need to have cultural knowledge and experience and language to do that effectively. And you cannot ask a normal mainline all source analyst to do that. And their brains aren't designed to do that kind of work, nor should they. Mm-hmm. And you can't ask a human collector to do that kind of work, really, because that's not how they're structured. That's not what they do.
Yeah.
And so the argument for having at least a group of people who specialize in these sorts of skills, I think, is very, very important. And there has to be a tradecraft and a process and a knowledge base and just a way of thinking about where in the world could I find commercial information or gray information and go about and get that. That won't ever happen.
Yeah.
In mainline agencies.
Right.
Yes.
Unless we disrupt. There are people who are assigned to do that. Peter, I'm sorry I spoke so much.
No. I'm torn on there. I look at creating another agency, and then I look at the US system and think, do they need 18, 19? Do we need enough with 10 in our national intelligence community? And that scares me from an administrative expense those burdens there. But then I also look and think, if there's a bit of a culture at the moment that says we can all do open source, we can all listen to the radio, read the newspaper, and that's not, to my mind, real open source. So recognizing it as its own discipline, that mm-hmm. there's a creative element to it, that there's a development, there's time, that there's chasing down leads that'll go nowhere. Recognizing it as its own discipline, its own tradecraft is critical. And how do you snap the old system into something in the new one? And maybe creating that agency is one of the methods you can do that as well, to make it really explicit that there's a different agency with a different remit, different powers, different legislation, et cetera, to get after open source as well. And I don't mind, I'm quite persuaded, Ben, by your competitive argument as well. I don't think it's a binary choice here, right? Mm-hmm. It having open source intelligence assessments and classified is okay, and it should make essentially both better mm-hmm. in the long run too. So I don't think it comes at a loss of this. I think there's always a time and a place for secrets. I just worry about how we shock the system and get it moving down that one.
Yeah,
I think one of the arguments against it is this idea of integration. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I worry a lot about in the U.S. system, that that a separate agency that is assigned to do this will never be integrated effectively with the other kinds of exquisite secret collection. And I see the power of these things working together to being so much more. Right. So if you take that Bellingcat example, but you added on the ability of the human officer or the SIGINT collector to be able to add in their piece of the puzzle, boy, you could really do things.
Yeah.
And I worry that creating a separate agency, there would never be this integration because of the competitive nature of it. So those are the days that I think it's a terrible idea to have a separate agency. And I think that working this through is something we need to do.
Yeah. We're running short on time, but I just do want to respond on the integration argument, because I do, in my paper, I do think that is the strongest argument against an OSINT agency, is that it does, you have to be honest, it runs completely counter to the logic of integration. But the answer to that, to me, is to step back and say, okay, integration remains an important goal, but at what point do we want to integrate? And if we persist in trying to integrate OSINT under a secret umbrella, I think we lose a lot of the advantages of OSINT. So I really think that integration needs to be something more dynamic. It needs to have a bit of that competitive edge to it, even though that may be a challenge to manage. But again, I think that's where we need a strong kind of central body. So in Australia's case, ONI, I think, really has to play that role. I mean, a much more radical argument is that actually you don't depend on the IC for OSINT at all. You have OSINT being generated completely by the private sector or by, you know, a government agency that's not part of the IC, and you have that competitive friction really allowed to play out, but then you really lose the potential for integration altogether. So that's why I think it needs to be part of the NIC.
One of the solutions to that is by taking the idea that Andrew Scheer has put out there of really focusing on these multidisciplinary teams maybe interagency teams, mm-hmm. if you could say it that way, where if you did have a separate agency, you force people to actually come together on a regular basis and work on problem sets together.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to finish on the Independent Intelligence Review. So that's the Australian review that's underway at the moment. We do these every 4 or 5 years or so. We don't do them when there's a crisis. Luckily, we get to sit back and think. I've already said what I think the intelligence review should focus on. Maybe, Beth, you have too when you talked about the teams, but if you have other thoughts or recommendations for the review, be interested to hear them now. And you too, Peter. Perhaps I'll go to you first, Beth.
I do not feel that I should make any judgments about the Australian intelligence community. I feel that I know too little, and I also have enough humility to know that just trying to take my experience and apply it on a totally different system is probably not wise. There are things that you can certainly learn from the way that we do business, but I think I've told every visitor when I was working in the intelligence community and someone would come in and say, oh, we really want to learn from how you do it. And I would say, no, you don't. Because if I were going to engineer how we were going to do things, we would never look like this. We would never do it like this. We've just kind of evolved and made it work. But rarely is a system that's evolved over as many years as we have with as big of a bureaucracy actually structured in the way that anyone would do it on purpose.
Good advice.
So for me, and I think you outlined it in the intro to the question there, Ben, was we're not doing this in response to a crisis. There's nothing that's fallen off a cliff in that sense that we're spawning. And we have the luxury of sitting back and testing and adjusting the system here. It's one of the strengths of the Australian system. But that being said, so without a crisis, so what are we changing? What's the review team going after? The terms of reference are quite broad, and I certainly feel for the review team in what they have to achieve. One of the things that comes to mind for that for me is there's a body of academic literature around how knowledge organizations adapt and evolve over time. So for me, one of the things I'm really passionate about is reconceiving the intelligence community as a knowledge organization rather than a secrets organization, if that makes sense.
Totally.
And then from a knowledge point of view, that opens the doors to my mind. That mm-hmm. opens the doors to multi-classification workforces. It opens it to diversity. It opens it to the open source agency question that you asked before. And I think that one to me, if I'm a knowledge organization, I can become far more useful to far more people. And that's sometimes a scary proposition, but I think that's the biggest one. But I'm not sure how to craft that recommendation to the team and go, look, it's a cultural thing you're up against here. Mm. It's a cultural change that we need to make. If there's no intelligence failure, then what are we trying to do? The argument to not change this is also hard. So the intelligence community's never been as well funded, never been as well resourced for people. It's grown and grown over the last couple of decades. So those positions are hard to ask for. But what are we doing in that sense? And I think changing to a knowledge perspective opens the doors to so many more recommendations that I would have.
Wonderful. We've gone way over time. We could keep going for much longer, but we're going to have to end it there. So thank you very much. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Beth.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Beth.